Alison.
Hi, Sarah. So France is on high alert and we're starting to see more armed soldiers patrolling the streets here in Paris and other big towns.
Yeah. France has raised its security alert to the highest level after last week's terror attack in Moscow.
The attack was claimed by a branch of the Islamic State armed group, the same group that carried out the Paris attacks in 2015.
Yeah, and the French government says that the threat from Islamist terrorists in France is real, and that the group has made a number of attempts to launch attacks on French soil, including to this year.
Yeah, recently schools have received worrying messages with bomb threats. They've thankfully turned out to be hoaxes, but it has thrown security forces into high action.
Yeah, actually, my kid's school is actually involved in one of those right now. They received a message yesterday. Police cleared out the students, evacuated them to neighboring schools, and today things are still closed. They continued the checks. So, even though we know it's likely to be a hoax, I mean, a very bad one, it's all a bit disconcerting.
It is. And with the start of the Olympic Games just four months away, ensuring security is going to be even more of a headache. So, Sarah, 143 people, including some children, were killed in the attack in Moscow last week in a concert hall.
Yeah, that brings up memories of the 2015 attacks here at the Bataclan concert hall. Mm-hmm. President Emmanuel Macron expressed France's solidarity with the victims, their loved ones, and all the Russian people. He also reportedly suggested that France and Russia increase their cooperation on counterterrorism.
Yeah, let's work together. Mm. But there was no mention of him picking up the phone to call President Vladimir Putin like he used to do.
Yeah.
And in fact, Macron has warned against instrumentalization or distortion after Putin tried to pin the Moscow attack on Ukraine without coming up with any evidence.
Yeah, Macron is now one of Putin's biggest critics. And he recently shocked many EU countries, saying that France wouldn't rule out sending troops to help Ukraine win the war.
But this is a very recent turnabout, because for the last 150 years or so, France has had a rather pro-Russia policy, first with the Empire, then the Soviet Union, and then the Russian Federation. And in each case, France has allied with Russia against a common enemy. So back in the 19th century under Emperor Napoleon III, the common enemy was Prussia, which would become Germany. And then, of course, during World War II, Nazi Germany was the enemy. Mm. Coming out of the war, though, it was the US, which France saw as wielding excessive influence. Now, I talked to journalist Elsa Vidal, who is head of RFI's Russia service, about this. She's just written a book called La Fascination Russe, France's Fascination with Russia. And when she was researching it, she found that the way France's political, military and diplomatic elites view Russia has been coloured by, well, a certain anti-Americanism. And it's led to a certain complacency, even blindness, over Putin's increasingly autocratic rule.
Each time I was trying to raise the issue of Russian foreign policy, people, and especially the French politician or member of the elite that I was talking with, were telling me, answering or questioning me, like, what about the US? What about Afghanistan? What about Guantanamo? And I was consistently trying to go back to the Russian foreign policy, but it still seemed to be quite relevant to the people I was speaking with that we should first discuss the US and the US heavy influence on world current affairs. I admit that there are war crimes that were committed by the US, but still, I was very much eager to discuss not the US legacy, but the Russian political influence of Russian imperialism. And this way, I discovered that anti-Americanism is a very powerful force and political leverage in France.
And it really emerged in a very clear way, didn't it? After the Second World War, with de Gaulle, France was in a terrible state.
It was.
What was the problem with the US and why did de Gaulle lean towards Russia, the USSR at the time?
There was pretty good basis for resentment towards the US. If we speak from de Gaulle's point of view, he was not the only freedom fighter speaking on behalf of France during the Second World War. And there has been time when the US were having second thought. They were not quite sure they wanted to support him in the first place. And they were also questioning the support de Gaulle as a military, non-elected military chief would get among the French population after the World War, they were to support him. And there was also the other very, very concerning issue that the US authorities were in favor of imposing an occupation administration to France, a little bit like they did with Japan. And for the French political representative at the time, it was an option they absolutely didn't want. But we have to say, to be fair, that finally the US decided to support General de Gaulle and no occupation government was imposed. But we still seem to be quite concerned with them, wanted to dominate us, and we are still being advised or governed by people whose mind were molded immediate after Second World War, and probably the way they see the world and analyze the world is very, very much flavored by this heritage. And I think it's not accurate. And
yeah, you
and
talk about a certain blindness. They've kind of fallen for a fictional Russia.
Exactly. And it's not because we are just romantic and involved with the idea that Russia would be the heir of the USSR. It's because the Russian leadership has been very much aware of each nation, European nation's torments, what is painful for each of us, and what could be a very useful leverage to build alliances. And when it comes to France, it is based on this Second World War resentment toward the US, maybe also to the fact that we have been saved twice by the US, so it's quite embarrassing for those in France who think that we have to be recognized as a great power in the political game. And those who long for the empire that we lost.
Yeah, you refer to this sort of need to restore some lost glory.
And this is something I really, really found intriguing, that French politicians and French military sometimes feel sympathy towards Russia because Russia twice did crumble and then was reborn. And even the Imperia was reborn. And the first time was in 1917. And the second time was after the collapse of the Soviet Union. And nowadays, Vladimir Putin is promoting a new vision of Russia, which has a lot in common with imperialism. And I think it's attractive to part of the French audience who is still nostalgic about the times when France was an empire and at the very center of a colony.
This fascination continued with Jacques Chirac from the right, particularly under Nicolas Sarkozy, who was a big fan of Vladimir Putin. However, somehow the magic didn't work with the socialist president, François Hollande.
Yes.
So he was president from 2012 to 2017 and stood up to Putin. Following Crimea, he scuppered the deal that had been signed under Nicolas Sarkozy to sell Mistral to Russia. It was a big financial loss to France.
Exactly. And it was for a president that was sometime bashed for being too normal. I think he took the only decision that was historically necessary and that all French allies had been asking for, especially after Crimea has been annexed.
You refer to Hollande not falling for the Putin cocktail. One third seduction, one third brutality, one third surprise, and then a bit of lies.
Exactly.
How come?
I tried to discuss it with him, with the former President Hollande, because I was quite surprised of this singularity. And then he told me that, you know, he saw the cocktail being shaken in front of him, and that's why he didn't fall for it. From my own end, I think it might be because the Socialist Party in France was pretty much into fighting totalitarian regime, and especially USSR. So maybe this served as a counterpoison and helped President Hollande resisting this attraction that has been quite effective.
It's worked.
It worked on the previous and to a certain extent on the next president as well.
So moving on to President Emmanuel Macron, who has really done what can only be described as a U-turn on Russia.
Definitely.
Back in May 2022, shortly after Russia invaded Ukraine, Macron actually came out and said we shouldn't humiliate Russia, and said it was very important to continue dialogue. You've described that statement as having the effect of a bomb.
Exactly. It was very difficult in front of the Bucha, Izium and Irpin war crimes to hear the consistency with which the French president was still trying to maintain good relation with the aggressor, although all signs were clearly pointing out that the aggressor was not only trying to invade the country, but was absolutely not paying any respect to the rule of war. And that's why all the Eastern countries that are now part of the EU and most of it part of NATO were crying for a firmer position in front of Russia, because such statement, it was used and regarded as giving more credit to the Russian position than to the Ukrainian position. And this was not really understandable.
Having been criticized for seemingly being too soft on Russia, Macron is now being criticized by some other European states for being too warmongering, because recently he said we cannot rule out sending troops from Europe to Ukraine to help Ukraine with the war effort and to beat Russia. So a radical change.
Yes, that's a little bit confusing, I think, also for the French audience, because we used to be the last one willing to oppose Russia, and now we are kind of leading the way. So you turn as you put it. But I think the only thing that is common is that we are alone. We are leading and kind of isolated, but not to say that we are weak. No, Emmanuel Macron does seem to enjoy being the disruptive element and leading the way one way or the other. Mm. So we are back in our favorite position. Now we have to build consensus around us. And it's true, it would have been even more powerful if, let's say, if France and Germany would have come in front of the public and their citizens to say, we have discussed it extensively and we have come to the conclusion that we are not excluding sending one day personnel on the ground. And this is only speaking of it and slightly opening the window or the curtains on what is going on, I would say, in the backstage, things that the Russian leadership must know of already. So everybody is playing his part, but honestly, we are not escalating. We are just putting ourselves in a position that allows us to defend our interests nowadays.
Elsa, as someone who speaks fluent Russian, has spent time there, has learned a lot about the Russian culture, has your relationship, your feelings about the language or the culture changed over the years as President Putin has become more and more autocratic and is currently waging war against Ukraine?
I still very much love the Russian language. I don't feel the need to refrain from speaking Russian at all. I do also feel for the Russian people who are drawn into a war that they didn't want and that are now suffering from a very, very acute repression. But what gives me hope is that the regime has entered into a very dangerous time. It must win the war if it doesn't want to perish. So it's dangerous for us all. But there are also good change that the regime will disappear if he loses the war. So I think it gives us a very clear objectives. And if we want to have a sovereign, stable and peaceful Europe, the best asset for us would be to have a democratic Russia. So I'm surprised that we didn't yet raise the issue of regime change. It used to be very common some 20 years ago. It has become a taboo, but I think we should go back to that, because there is no better ally for France and for Germany than a democratic Russia in Europe.
T'as pensé à payer ta taxe foncière, taxe immobilière, taxe professionnelle, taxe sur le personnel, taxe d'apprentissage, taxe si t'es pas sage, taxe sur tout ce qui bouge, sur tes clopes et sur ton rouge, sur tes cachets d'aspirine, sur ta vodka et sur ton jean. Salut, T-V-A, bien.
So that's Les Inconnus singing about taxes, a hit song in the 1990s.
Only in France could you have a hit song about tax.
It's true, but I wanted us to play it because we're talking about the VAT, the TVA, the value-added tax. So, Alison, have you ever noticed when you buy something, you look at the receipt and there's a bunch of different numbers there. There's one number, often a second number, or there's like a percentage of it.
And the second one is much higher, and that's the one that, alas, you have to pay.
Yeah, and for most things, it's 20% higher. And this is the TVA, the value-added tax, VAT. born here in France 70 years ago on April 10th, 1954. So the VAT was introduced to simplify what had become a jumble of taxes after World War II, and there was starting to be a revolt amongst business owners and artisans against what they called a vampire state, I guess eating up all their profits. France's tax code dates back to royal times.
Well, of course, kings needed money.
Yes, yes. And the idea of a consumption tax, you know, something where you tax things that you buy, that was introduced during the Revolution, which imposed taxes on tobacco, alcohol, and salt. Napoleon codified that. And then fast forward to the end of World War II, France was rebuilding and trying to raise money. The government created the DGI, the Tax Directorate, in 1948. And when Maurice Loret took over as its director in 1952, he took it as his mission to simplify and reduce the tax burden on businesses, because this protest movement against high taxes was growing, backed by a group of far-right lawmakers, including Jean-Marie Le Pen.
Yeah, so the guy who founded the populist National Front party, today called the National Rally.
Yeah, yeah, and having increasingly success in France. Loret, so the head of the tax office, was inspired by a concept introduced by a German industrialist, Wilhelm von Siemens, of the Siemens family, which is still around today, making washing machines and things like that, who in the 1920s, he proposed the idea of taxing what was added throughout the production process. So it's a bit technical, but to better understand the concept, I talked to economist Julien Blasco of Sciences Po University.
The thing about VAT is that it is meant to be paid by the customer at the end of the day. So in that respect, it's not very different from a sales tax. But what's very specific about this tax is that it is measured and collected by each intermediate business which is going to come into the production process. So that means that every actor has to measure the value of what they are producing and they have to report it. So that makes it a very powerful tool for the administration.
So it's a powerful tool in that it brings in a lot of money. Today, nearly half of France's revenue, over 155 billion euros in 2021. Compare this to 74 billion brought in by the income tax. So a lot more comes in from the VAT tax. I thought that was interesting. I didn't quite realize that. Now, back in 1954, the idea of the VAT was really not embraced at first. Loret fought for it, though, and it passed in Parliament thanks to the support of Pierre Mendès-France, who served as the chair of the Finance Committee in the National Assembly and later served as prime minister for a few months. The law passed on the 10th of April, 1954. And at first, it was quite restrained, so it only applied to the relatively small number of companies that were registered with the tax office. By the end of the 60s, it was expanded to all businesses.
And since then, it's been picked up in countries all over the world.
Absolutely. Other countries adopted the VAT pretty quickly. Today, there are 150 countries or over 150 countries that have a VAT tax. And it's a requirement for countries who want to join the EU.
So it raises a lot of money, but it doesn't sound like the most progressive or fairest of taxes.
No, no. And the VAT is criticized for the fact that it applies to all consumers, regardless of their income. So unlike the income tax, which is a progressive tax, so the rate increases the more you earn, the VAT, so a consumption tax, is the same for all consumers. And this, Julien Blasco told me, is problematic.
So the richer you are, the less consumption taxes represent a share of your income. Poorest households spend all their income, while richest households, they can save up to 50% of their income. So actually, when you have a fixed tax rate, for example, 20% for VAT, well, the 20% is applied only on what you consume, not what you earn. So for the poorest households that spend all of their income, the 20% tax rate is 20% of their income. While if you only consume 50% of what you earn, this 20% tax rate, well, it becomes 20% on half of your income. So it's actually a 10% tax rate.
Now, a lot of France's tax and social policies are progressive, so you pay or contribute more the more you earn.
So it does seem strange then, doesn't it, for France to be so dependent on what appears to be a rather regressive tax?
Yeah, yeah. Well, Julien Blasco told me it's actually a trade-off.
So VAT is a regressive tax, but actually it raises a lot of money which will be used by the welfare state for social transfers, public services. So The question is, are you taking with one hand what you are giving with another? And actually, what we find when we compare social fiscal systems between countries is that there is a clear correlation between the level of indirect and consumption taxes and the size of the wealth estate. You can say that taxes such as VAT are necessary in order to support significant wealth estates. When you study the gross national perspective, you see that actually countries with the biggest wealth estates, which are primary European countries, they all have a strong basis of consumption taxes.
He says that VAT could be made more progressive by setting different rates for different things. In France right now, the standard VAT is 20%. So this is on most goods and services. It's 5.5% for food. And then there's an even lower rate of 2.1% for medicine. But an intermediary rate of 10%, which applies to raw materials and building renovations, for example, it also applies to cafes and restaurants.
Well, you know, this is the country of eating and drinking.
Yeah.
Although you could argue that maybe not for lowest income earners.
Yeah, yeah. So today, 70 years later, the VAT is an integral part of France's finances, even if you could say it could be improved.
Je veux pas des cheveux en paille, pas de bacotille. Mes cheveux longs, faut qu'ils glissent et qu'ils brillent. Mes cheveux, c'est ma faille, j'aime quand ils s'entortillent. J'aime quand ils pointillent et qu'ils touchent mes papilles. Mais plus les jours repassent, plus je suis indécis. Dans l'écho de la glace, une future calvitie. Faudrait-il que je coupe ou que je tonifie? Marie me dégoûte et je me tue mes filles.
So now we're going to talk about the very important subject of hair with Jess Phelan. Hi, Jess.
Hi. Yeah, so I wanted to ask, has anyone ever commented on your hair at work? Has a boss ever told you to change your hair?
No. But a colleague who was a TV news presenter said that she was required to straighten her very curly hair before going on air. So
that's one of the reasons I chose radio, actually. I do not want to have to spend a lot of time straightening my hair.
That is an advantage. Well, this has never happened to me either, that someone at work has told me to change my hair. I've got straight blonde hair. But if you ask people who have very curly hair, especially people of Black African descent, you hear a lot of stories. Mm. This is Fonta, a former police officer, speaking to our RFI colleague Sylvie Coffey.
On me convoquait dans le bureau en disant, on sait que tu tiens tes cheveux. J'ai dit, ah bon, pas toi?
So Fanta says she was called into the office and told, we know your hair's important to you, but can you straighten it because it doesn't look professional? And she says that even if she did that, it would go curly again as soon as she took a shower because that's just how it grows. So in fact, she says it's like her bosses were telling her, we don't accept you for who you are. And it's not just women who experience this. Here's Louis, a student in his early 20s.
Mais c'est vrai qu'il y a certaines fois où j'ai eu des rendez-vous pour des stages étudiants et j'ai compris que ça gênait un petit peu et que.
So he's saying there have been times when he's applied for internships and he's realized that his braids are a problem for the people interviewing him and that they'd probably prefer if he had what he calls a straighter hairstyle, like a short back and sides. So in the United States, this is considered a form of discrimination.
Yeah. Several U.S. states have laws against this.
Yeah, so 24 states so far have passed something called the Crown Act, which says that penalizing people for wearing their hair in an afro or locks or braids is a kind of racial discrimination, and people should be protected against it at work or at school, for example. Now, France is also considering legislation against hair discrimination. This week, the National Assembly began debating a proposal to add hair to France's existing laws against discrimination. Olivier Serva is the MP from the French Caribbean island of Guadeloupe who put forward the bill.
Il s'agit de dire non à la discrimination capillaire, quelle que soit la longueur.
So he says it's about saying no to discrimination on the basis of hair, whatever the length, color, or texture. And that it largely concerns people of African descent, but not only. And this is actually a really important difference between the legislation in the US and what's being proposed here. So in the US, this is categorized as racial discrimination targeting predominantly Black people. But in France, the idea is to classify it much more broadly as discrimination on the basis of physical appearance, which is already banned. So in theory, and this is something its supporters have been really careful to stress, it would also apply to people with blonde hair, if someone assumes they're stupid, or people with red hair who sometimes get teased for being ginger.
So not just Black people.
Right. Now, the person who first came up with the idea for this bill in France is a woman from Guadeloupe, Guylaine Conquet. She used to be a journalist for French TV, and now she's an artist and an activist living in the US. And she spoke to me from her home in Atlanta and told me that the laws in the US had inspired her to ask that MP, Olivier Servat, to draft this bill. But she says the French version is different in two important ways.
In France, if the hair discrimination bill will pass, it's going to be historical because France is going to be the first country in the world to pass a national bill for hair discrimination. And what is more important is the law in France. It's not only for black hair or black people. We don't have, you know, in the French constitution, racial discrimination.
Okay, so what she means by that is that the French law is based on the idea that all French people are just French. You're not white French, you're not black French. The law doesn't make a distinction.
So this is the concept of universalism that we've spoken about before on the podcast. France takes a so-called colorblind approach to policies, whereby it doesn't separate people into different groups because, well, that would be seen as divisive.
Yes, whereas in the US, the thinking is that some issues affect different groups more than others, so you make policy to try and level that out. In France, it's actually hard to know exactly who suffers from hair discrimination because you're not allowed to collect statistics on race. And Guylaine Conquet sees it as positive that the French law wouldn't only apply to people with Afro hair like hers. She told me it makes it more inclusive and that she's spoken to blonde people who say they've been discriminated against at work too. But she also says that, yeah, the negative comments she's had as a black woman with natural hair, of course they're to do with her race.
When you tell me that my hair is not good, it's like you tell me my skin is not good either. You ask me to change my color skin. We should not have been forced to change the texture of our hair. We should not have been forced to conform to the European style. It's like you're asking me to look like you, and I'm not like you. France is diverse. France is not just French in Paris. French is all around the world. I'm Caribbean. I'm French Caribbean. So they have to acknowledge that my difference and accept it.
So that's a much bigger question for French society. But as for the hair discrimination bill, it has to pass the National Assembly and then the Senate to become law. And that's no sure thing. The law already bans discrimination on the basis of appearance or ethnicity. So some legal experts argue that it's redundant to specify that that includes hair. And they also point out that proving discrimination of any kind in court is notoriously difficult. But for Guylaine, whatever happens now, the main thing is that this bill has started a conversation.
You know, in 2022, when I reached out with Mr. Servat, the French congressman, to ask him to push this law, I never, ever realized that this request will end it at the French Parliament. Of course, that things are not going to change from today for tomorrow if the law is voted. But at least people are talking about that. You see, you're calling me. A lot of your friends, they didn't know about that. They say, oh, I didn't know you were offended when I was touching your hair. We don't like people touching our hair. So, yeah, we're going to speak about that. We're going to, you know, share our experience. This law, I hope, will make people, you know, talk more about this issue and not be complex anymore by the hair.
That was the artist and activist Guylaine Conquet speaking to me there, and the interviews that you heard in French were by RFI's Sylvie Coffey.
We've come to the end of Spotlight on France. We're a production of Radio France International. This episode was mixed by Cécile Pompiani.
And you can write to us. We're at spotlight.france@rfi.fr. Or send in your questions about France or anything else for that matter.
And if you like the show, please consider rating or even reviewing us on Apple Podcasts or Spotify or wherever you listen. You can find us on Instagram at Spotlight on France.
And we'll be back in about a month on April the 25th. In the meantime, why not look out for previous episodes on rfienglish.com or in the app where you're listening to this show. Bye-bye, Sarah.
Bye, Alison.
Jess.
Bye-bye. Bye.
avec plein de dreadlocks. Sur ma vision de passer ma vie en coloc. Je fais des cheveux avec une belle casquette. Pour des wolf voitures, je sens la croquette. Je fais des cheveux avec deux mètres qui pendent. Dans le monde entier, je veux devenir une légende. Je fais des cheveux qui puissent traverser le temps. Comme ça, je pourrais retourner dans l'espace. Je fais des cheveux avec plein de trous dedans. Être une éponge qui efface toutes les traces.